Mark 13, 32 through 37. Mark 13, 32. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey, when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or when the cock crows, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. Now, this is the final section of the Olivet Discourse, this great 13th chapter in the Gospel of Mark that immediately precedes the Passion narrative. Mark's Gospel has been called an extended Passion narrative with, introduction to the Passion narrative. Given the fact that this book only has 16 chapters, and three of which are devoted to the Passion proper, and at least three other or additional chapters prepare the way for the Passion, in more strict terms, that's certainly not an overstatement. We also said, and I think that this is very healthy to keep in mind, always to keep in mind when you read this chapter, the placement of Mark 13 as an introduction to the Passion narrative is to be given a fair or a due consideration. The placement of Mark 13 introducing the Passion narrative would suggest that the events that follow Mark 13 in some way or other are also a portrait of the end of the world. This would lead us to the conclusion that Mark, who is, among all the evangelists, the theologian of the cross par excellence, that Mark has an understanding of the cross as the end of the world as we know it or as we have known it. And if you compare this thought with the writings of the Apostle Paul, then you will certainly agree that this is not a novel thought in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul spoke of the coming of Christ or the cross of Christ as the end of the world, and that since the coming of Christ, a new creation is already in place, already in existence, and old things have passed away. So that the Apostle develops a new way of looking at the world, looking at himself, his life, at creation, at people, a way that is different from the way that he used to perceive the world and the meaning of his life. All of these things are true, and I think that Mark had an understanding of a similar kind. Once again, I say, Mark 13 as an introduction to the Passion narrative in some way also suggests that the events that follow, that is the Passion proper, the crucifixion, are the end of the world. Now, we have seen this in previous weeks in the first 23 chapters of Mark 13, which are preoccupied with events that lead up to 70 AD, but certainly also focus on the crucifixion of Christ himself. We then moved on to 24 through 27, 2 weeks ago, I believe, and we saw that these verses most likely are referring to a time that goes beyond 70 AD. And we said this for several reasons. First, the language takes a decided turn towards a more cosmological understanding of the events depicted in 24 through 27. Second, the shift from the second person plural, which up until this point and all the way through verse 23 was used to address the disciples that heard Jesus say these words on the Mount of Olives, where they were first heard and spoken, now shifts to the third person plural, they, suggesting that in some way the disciples are no longer the persons who experience this time frame described in verse 24. Also, and this is certainly unequivocal, Jesus himself has given us a temporal clue to the sequence that he had in mind here, because he says, in those days after that tribulation being a reference to the discourse in verses 4 through 23. Whatever 24 through 27 therefore talk about are events that happen after the cross, after 70 AD. Please recall, and I understand I'm bombarding you with information again, but I'm trying to pull it all together so that at least I do not feel like I've deprived you of anything. Please remember that in Jesus' understanding, the cross of Christ, the crucifixion, and the destruction of the temple, together with the Jewish wars and the destruction of Judah and Jerusalem, these events are all one complex. They belong together. This is already so on account of the logical connection between the cross and 70 AD. 70 AD, as we know from the parable of the wicked tenant, was God's judgment for the Jewish nation for rejecting the Messiah. And therefore, intimately related to the death of Jesus Christ. The two really form a unity in the plan, in the economy of God. Then we moved on to the lesson of the fig tree, and we saw that the lesson of the fig tree addresses the disciples. So the language of second person plural is resumed, suggesting that once again the disciples come into view as the people who will experience whatever is being in view here with the lesson of the fig tree. On one level, we said, this fig tree, and this is the very least that we would have to maintain. The lesson of the fig tree says, just as you know from growth in nature that summer is just around the corner, so it will be. There will be certain events, he calls them semilla, signs, that will portend the destruction of the temple. As the end of the Jewish nation, the end of the Old Testament way of life, if you will, the end of the old world. That the lesson of the fig tree in its historical setting should be seen as referring to 70 AD is because Jesus repeats a distinctive phrase that had governed the entire discourse from verses 4 through 23, a discourse which dealt with the destruction of the temple. Truly I say to you, this is verse 30, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And this phrase relates to verse 4, where the disciples ask Jesus, as they look at the temple from the Mount of Olives, and wonder at its greatness, and it was truly a momentous building in the days of Herod. They say, tell us, Jesus, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? And what follows then in this discourse is Jesus' answer. These are all these things that you will see in place before it happens. So then, this phrase being repeated in verse 30 would naturally refer back to verse 4 and the original question of the disciples concerning the destruction of the temple. We also said, and this is perhaps, at least in my view, this is a clincher. If you have, even with only limited knowledge of Greek, you can study the phrase "this generation" both in the New Testament and in the few instances where you find it in extra-biblical literature, and you will find that for any Greek-speaking individual, it is a phrase that refers to contemporaries. This generation refers to people that are alive during an address of one kind or another. It is also the case here. And we did study a couple of passages in the Gospel of Mark. We limited ourselves to Mark's testimony where that was the case. This generation does not have an ideal sense as referring to believers in general throughout all the ages. It doesn't refer to the human race in general throughout all the ages. This generation is a Greek way of referring to contemporaries, people who are still alive today. And so also here. Now we come to the final section of this discourse. And having said all this, I almost feel like we have to read it all over again, because you certainly have forgotten what it says, unless you are very, very knowledgeable of this passage. Be that as it may, let me say this. Without any further ado, we can say that this final passage, this final section in the Olivet Discourse, deals with the day of the Lord. Because Jesus' reference to that day or that hour is prophetic shorthand for the day of the Lord. Ezekiel 30, for example, to give you only one reference from the Old Testament where something similar language is being used, Ezekiel 30, verse 2, wail, alas, for the day, speaking of the day of the Lord. For the day is near, the day of the Lord is near. It will be a day of clouds, a time of doom for the nations, and so forth. That day and that hour certainly refers to the day of the Lord. This is, again, a prophetic idiom. It is the language that the prophets of the Old Testament used to use, and Jesus also speaks as a prophet in this apocalyptic discourse. The first thing I'd like to throw out here for you to discuss is what do you make of the fact that no one knows the day and the hour? And in particular, what do you make of the fact that not even the Son knows that day and that hour? There's an expectation. There may even be signs. But the precise timing is reserved for the counsel of God. No one knows it, not even Jesus. It may surprise you, and maybe it doesn't, but it may surprise you that the saying of the unknown end was a staple of apocalyptic literature from 200 BC all the way through 100 AD to the destruction of the temple. Then the Jewish nation ceased to exist, and there was literature being produced that looked back to the oral teachings of the rabbis prior to the destruction of the temple. This literature that we have, chiefly from the Qumran scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, found shortly after the Second World War, contains several apocalyptic writings. And in these writings, the unknowability of the exact day of the day of the Lord is very clearly set forth. Let me give you one example. Here are the Psalms of Solomon, chapter 17, verse 2. This is a document that very likely dates back to the first century, AD, not BC. But it says here, "See, Lord, and raise up for them their king, the son of David, to rule over your servant Israel in the time known only to you, O God, our Redeemer." This concept, by the way, which is found in two or three other passages in the intertestamental literature and also very clearly set forth, is not even, is not even without parallel in the Old Testament. I draw your attention to the text in Zechariah 14, verse 7, in which the coming of the day of the Lord is portrayed. And there in Zechariah 14, 7, it says, "There shall be a unique day which is known only to the Lord, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light." So to place the saying of Jesus, which has bewildered so many people, about which so many questions have been raised, is first of all to be seen and understood in its original setting, in which this was nothing unheard of. It was quite common to affirm that the precise timing, the day of the Lord, would remain unknown until its actual arrival. The saying that not even the Son of God, not even the Son, would know the hour is still intriguing. I'm sure you've heard the argument that Jesus, having become a human being, also restricted himself or limited himself as to his knowledge of the times of the end, and also in regards to a couple of other things. Jesus of Nazareth, although divine, in some mysterious sense, limited his knowledge of things divine. Otherwise, I can guarantee you, I am certain, even if it seems to contradict the plain reading of this text, apart from the incarnation and the Son of God becoming man, there is no way that the Son would not know the day or the hour of his return. The same, by the way, would be true of the Holy Spirit. There is no fact, there is no knowledge that you could take away from God. God knows, and he knows all things. But as for the Son, and as for his role as the sin-bearer, and as the one who would become flesh, take on the seed of Abraham, as the writer to the Hebrews used to say, he did limit himself in knowledge. Also, I would draw your attention to the words of Acts chapter 1, verse 7, which we have heard some months ago in our study of the book of Acts. Notice what it said there. When the disciples asked Jesus after his resurrection, but prior to his ascension, "Are you now going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" Jesus' answer to this was, "The Father has set the times and seasons in his own authority." This would be to the same effect. It's very similar to what you read in Mark 13:32. But Mark 13:32 includes a further thought. It is the part of the Son to leave these times in the Father's hands, for the mark of the Son was to walk in complete obedience to the Father. Maintain unreserved obedience to the Father in heaven. And I think that the words of 13:32 speak to this issue. One of the things that I shall say are all too human is not to know the day of death, not to know the day of the end. And Jesus, therefore, I don't wish to speak of logic because that's a misnomer. But for this very reason, and for this reason alone, Jesus limited his knowledge. To be human also means not to know. So even though he is the Son, he could not have known the day or the hour, the exact timing. Otherwise, he would not have been human in the sense that we all are. There's also another possibility that has been suggested by a few theologians, and that is to say that knowing the day and the hour is not so much a reference to timing per se, but to the experiential aspect of the day and the hour. That is, not knowing the day and the hour has reference to experiencing it. If you think in terms of the Son being crucified, for example, as the day of the Lord, that certainly would hold true. Jesus could not know the day and the hour. When you look at the Son of God in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he is bearing the sins and the weight of God's judgment becomes tangible, a tangible experience, he is perplexed. And he resorts to beseeching the Father to remove the cup, if at all possible. He did not even he, did know what it would be like to experience the awful, awful, awful day of the Lord. That's a possibility too. I consider it less likely, though. However, please remember what we said about the concept of the eschatological day of the Lord. The day of the Lord comes in two installments. The first installment of the day of the Lord is yes, it is the first coming of Christ, including, please don't forget this, 70 AD. That's one package. Once you see this, this discord starts to make sense and to gel. If you see the cross as the end of the world, as the day of the Lord, including 70 AD. That's one complex. Okay, and the second application or the second installment is the end of time, the return or the second coming of Christ. First, then, we will examine the words of verse 35, in which we read, "Stay awake. You do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or when the cock crows, or in the morning." And we will see that these four time references are a tacit reference, or a tacit way of pointing to the passion of Christ as the day of the Lord. In this I say nothing else but what I have said before in recent weeks. In some ways, in many ways, Mark 13 teaches us to see the passion of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, as the end of the world. Now, this is not exclusive. The end of the world has more than just the crucifixion. It holds more than just 70 AD. There is also the end of the world. But in this context, the cross is a major player. It's very, very important, of paramount importance. And I believe that when Jesus spoke these words, he had his crucifixion very much in the forefront of his thinking. First of all, I would like to turn to 14:41 and the words of Jesus after he finds the disciples sleeping in the garden the third time. Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It's enough. The hour has come. Now this word, the hour has come, 14:41, is almost certainly an echo of that day and that hour of 1332. At the very least, I wish to suggest to you that it shouldn't be discounted. Being in such proximity in the neighborhood of 1332, and the talk of the hour being so loaded with biblical, prophetic, eschatological implications, I think you could draw a straight line between 1441 and 1332. Also, notice that this language of staying awake, keeping awake, being alert, watching, this language occurs in this context again because the disciples precisely did not stay awake, and they did not keep awake, and they were not alert, but they fell asleep. Is this accidental, that the language here at the beginning of the Passion echoes the words of Christ from 1332 through 37? I, for one, would argue certainly not. There is a connection. And if you see the cross as the end of the world, as I believe Mark did, that's the answer. That's where we would find it. And another textual feature in regards to the Passion narrative deserves our attention. These four watches of the night happen to be the time references that Mark uses in structuring the sequence of the Passion narrative, beginning with chapter 14:1 and through the beginning of chapter 15. You will find these four references at critical junctions as we turn the page from one main event during the Passion to the next. So, the Last Supper, when did it happen? Catherine, when did the Last Supper happen? And that's at what time of the day? In the evening. Yeah? And if you turn to 14:17, there it is. When it was evening, he came with the 12, the rest you know. The Last Supper took place in the evening. Jesus' betrayal and his prayer in the garden when he started to suffer happened when? Well, after the evening time, that is, at night time. It happened at midnight, or at least very, very, very close to it. Next, we come to the trial of Jesus. That's the next big chapter, big section in the Passion narrative, and Peter's betrayal at this or during the trial. When did that happen? Early in the morning? Actually, at the cock crow. That's right. And early in the morning, the next time, by the way, that reference is 14. 1472. Immediately the rooster crowed a second time. Peter's denial during the trial of Jesus. So this now is the third time reference lifted from 1332 through 37. And then, of course, early in the morning, at dawn. And here two events are candidates. And I think that you don't even need to choose between them. The one is the trial before Pilate. This would be the very next section in the Passion narrative. That was very early in the morning, basically at dawn. And the resurrection, let's not forget that. The resurrection is explicitly said to have happened 16:2, very early at dawn on the first day of the week when the sun had risen. So you can see that the passion narrative is structured around these four time references. And when you put all of this together with what we've said about the passion narrative in relation to Mark 13, 32 through 37, the totality of the evidence points in the direction of seeing the cross as the fulfillment of that day and that hour. So, the suffering and death of Jesus is not just the death of a martyr among many other martyrs in an evil world in which violence and oppression win out, but it has cosmic significance. It has cosmic sweep. It is the end of the world. It is the day of the Lord. And the world will never be the same. Something happened when Jesus was crucified. Something was unleashed upon the world that would leave it changed forevermore. The cross is the end of the world. Or if you want to put it this way, it is the beginning of the end. Step one or chapter one in the end of the world. And when you look at the four time references that are built into the structure, or that actually do structure the passion narrative, as you go from each time reference to the next, the anticipation is heightened. And you, as the reader, come to see that the day of the Lord is not over until Christ is raised. The whole passion narrative is portrayed as the day of the Lord. Any questions? I want to stop here and give you the opportunity to make comments or raise questions. Wonderful. Yeah, I'm thankful that you make this reference, because what should have been said, what I should have said, is that there were, of course, also other accompanying circumstances. Think of earthquake, think of darkness, think of graves being opened and people walking around, whatever that means. It's hard to picture it, but it happened. And, as you rightly pointed out, the veil of the temple torn in two. And pulling together what we've learned about the imagery or the symbolism of the temple, that temple veil torn in two means at least one of two things. I believe there are two implications. One is it's the end of the world. Can't say it any other way. It always comes down to the same idea. The temple is a picture of the whole cosmos. The temple is a picture of the whole cosmos. I won't go into any more detail at this point. Don't want to trouble you with this, but once it is understood that this temple, this edifice in Jerusalem, just as the tabernacle that Moses manufactured in the wilderness, was a picture of the entire cosmos inhabited by God, the tearing open of this veil that signifies the separation between the visible world in which we live and move and have our being, and the Holy of Holies, where no man could ever go, under no circumstances, except for the high priest and only once a year, signifying that space in which God dwells, where no man has access, where no man can be. That veil being torn apart means that the blueprint of this world, the foundation of this world is done away with. The world as we know it has come to an end. The separation between the dwelling place of God in the heavens and the dwelling place of man on the earth is obsolete. It doesn't exist anymore. And there's also, of course, Steve, what was your question? Yes, yeah, very much so. Mm-hmm. John? No, and this is because most people do not tend to think in Old Testament prophetic terms. But your observation is very valid, and I agree with it. Totally agree with it. The nuance in Matthew is towards the second coming and not the first. But what I will say and what I intend to say tonight is that this passage is also speaking about the second coming, although the reference is more subdued than in Matthew. The evangelist did take that liberty to interpret Jesus' teachings and to emphasize certain things over others, thereby not fabricating teachings of Jesus that he never taught, but bringing out nuances that were already present. And they did this too, let's not forget it, under the guidance and the tutelage and the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. So this is under God's supervision. But you're right, Matthew 24 has a thrust that would bring us to the second coming of Christ rather than the first. Any other observations? Good. Then let me talk about the fact that this passage also talks about the second coming of Christ and not just the first. It is one thing to see these four time references as structuring the passion narrative, which certainly is significant. It is one thing to say that since the second person plural is used, even through 32 through 37, the disciples in one way or another live through it, and this would be true if there is a reference to the cross intended here. But then you come to verse 37, and Jesus says, "What I say to you, I say to all, stay awake." This reference, then, is suggesting that the instruction to the disciples were always understood to be not only for this generation, that is the disciples, but also for the church or the New Testament believer. And that raises the question, why then should we know about this? What can we learn from this? Okay. Once again, what we can learn from this as the New Testament church is A, the cross is the end of the world. No evangelist, except for Mark, makes this point. Well, that isn't true either. No, it's not true. But no one is more emphatic about it as Mark. And I've tried to lay out the evidence before you, guiding us in this direction. The cross is the end of the world. Now, if this is not significant for Christians, then tell me what is. Mark 13, in connection with, or as an introduction to, the Passion narrative, wants to teach you that your world that you construct for yourself has come to an end. That you ought not to think the way that the rest of the world thinks of your existence, of this world, of your job, of your time, of your family, but you ought to think of it in light of the cross, the end of the world. The world is never the same. It's all different. That's significant. Mark understood this, and we have to take due notice of this. Secondly, what Jesus talks about in terms of the day of the Lord, in terms of the fig tree, in fact, throughout the Olivet Discourse, is in some sense, or you could say by extrapolation, also a preview of the end of time. True, he does answer the question of the disciples, and it does relate to the destruction of the temple. But the destruction of the temple symbolizes the end of the world, the end of the old order, as Steve put it. Therefore, whatever Jesus speaks of in regards to the first coming and 70 AD, in some sense also finds its parallel at the end of the world. Now the question, can you think of some elements in Jesus' teaching that we would also expect at the end of time that would confirm this conclusion or suggestion, if you will? Yes. That refers to the time after the cross, Satan being bound. I believe so. The cross and the pouring out of the Holy Spirit, they both shed light on this concept of the binding of Satan. Yes, Paul affirms it. Mm-hmm. That's an obvious parallel. It's Day of Judgment. It's true. Therefore, the theophany or the signs of theophany like darkness, the earth being shaken, we may expect them to relate to the coming of Christ as well. It will, after all, be the end of this world as we know it. But what about the premonitory signs, not the arrival of Christ itself? Does the New Testament give us any hint at all what can be expected prior to the coming of Christ? Huh? And what does that mean? Deception. Deception. And it means deception not only out in the world, but in the house of God, that is in the church. And as you go through or review the Olivet Discourse, one of the hallmarks of the sign of the destruction of the temple was false messiahs and false prophets taking the helm. And many were deceived by them. That language is also, and Kenneth referred to it, is found in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, which would have to be considered as a parallel, if only in a general sense. He speaks, Philippians. He speaks of the coming of Christ as being preceded by the lawless one who will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth and bring to nothing by the appearance of his coming. So this lawless one, the man of sin, is active prior to the coming, right up to the coming of Christ. The coming of the lawless one is by the activity of Satan. What does that mean? Well, he will come with supernatural power, false signs and wonders, and with all wicked deception for those who are perishing because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. That's parallel to the prediction that relates to the destruction of the temple and found in Mark 13. Can you think of anything else? Excuse me? Yes, and here we may remember John's reference to Matthew 24. Matthew actually contains this or includes this teaching of Jesus. He says, in some sense, it will be business as usual, so that there will be wars and rumors of wars, and they will continue right up to the end of time. Which is to say, the world at large will not give you significant clues or, let's say, conclusive clues that the end is here. Even though, and I think the Christians have always been wrong about this, this is the first place where Christians look. They look at the earth winding down because it is polluted, or they look at explosion of knowledge, or they look at the wickedness of the times. That relates to the world, and these things have come and gone. These are not signs of the end of time. So as it was in the days of Noah, so also it will be at the end of time. When Christ returns, people will do their business. And there it is. I think in general also, and this relates to the coming of the man of sin, we do expect a falling away of the church, the custodian of the truth, that is to be expected prior to the coming of Christ, and it was the case prior to the destruction of the temple. Jesus foretells this also in Mark 13. Again, if you were to turn to Matthew 24 as the parallel passage, there in verse, I believe, 15, Jesus speaks of the love of many, a scary verse, growing cold. Matthew 24, that's not 15, but verse 12. Because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. This isn't talking about the world, it's talking about the believers or the place where you would expect them to be. Yes. Yeah, in some sense, these things have always been true, but Jesus himself does make distinctions here. He does say, for example, many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and they will lead many astray. These things have not always been as profoundly evident as they were prior to 70 AD. And then, of course, he goes around and says, or he turns around and says, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. That's not a sign of the end. So there's a distinction here. Following your argument, look at verse 9. They will deliver you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them. And the gospel must first be proclaimed to all nations. That certainly was a sign for the apostles who first heard these words that the end was imminent. And when they saw the gospel going to the Gentiles, going to Rome in fact, they were more than justified in expecting the end in their own lifetime. The end being, of course, according to verse 4, the destruction of the temple. Whether you could argue that the apostles really believed that the end of the world proper came within their lifetime, that's arguable. I don't believe it, but it's quite possible. Certainly, many have argued it. But the question here in verse 4 relates to the destruction of the temple. And so this is a narrow time frame that sets the stage for our investigation. And before we go beyond this time frame and widen the scope to make a talk in terms of time throughout the era in which we live, the Christian era or the New Testament era, we really should be disciplined enough to limit ourselves to this and try to see the words of Jesus in the context of the question that is being answered in these verses. Well, we must ask ourselves the question, do we want to be found of Christ in idolatry when he returns, or awake and watchful? A young man is beaten to death in a large city because he challenged a couple of youths for kicking away the walking stick of an elderly man. As his life is ebbing away in the gutter, he remembers the last conversation just prior to this horrible crime, in which he was talking to his fiancée about their love and their hope for a future together. In another part of that large city, a young woman is getting up to get her baby from an afternoon nap, only to discover that it has perished of sudden infant death syndrome. That young woman remembers the last interaction with her baby, and she is heartbroken because she had slapped the baby in frustration over its crying and whining. This young lady will, for the rest of her life, live with a nagging regret that the last interaction with her baby was one of anger and not of love. Why do I tell you this? For the same reason we Christians are called to be watchful. Ask yourself whether your conduct today or this past week was befitting for a disciple of Christ. You must understand that even though today it is quite common to say that these teachings of Mark 13 that were delivered over just about 2 millennia ago have no bearing on our lives today anymore, this is not so. One, think of Grace in Eugene in the hospital right now, struggling for her life. Our life will come to an end, perhaps sooner than later, but it will come to an end. And secondly, the end of this world will come. It will occur. One day Christ will return, and then the party will be over. These things are certain. Therefore, we must be clear about this. Living or being a Christian does not just happen. That may be true of crabgrass and dandelion in the lawn, but it is not so with being a Christian. It requires careful attention, watchfulness, as Jesus says, alertness and cultivation. And let us not make our escape to notions of a harmless God who Voltaire used to mock, cannot but be gracious, can't he? He used to mock Jesus this way. Jesus is our loving Savior, and he is jealous over our hearts. But just as it is quite dangerous to ignore warnings over a period of time, so also those who block out the notion of the end of the world or the end of life and the judgment to come will do so at their own expense. No one can afford to kick away God's word for long. The question is whether we listen today and take His word seriously and let our lives be corrected, healed by Him. God will keep what He has promised. Therefore, Jesus warns all of us, stay awake. Don't fall asleep. Beasley Murray has written the most time-honored commentary on the Olivet Discourse. It is actually devoted to Mark 13, and it's a very sizable book. And he says, staying awake means, quote, faithful service to the Master, diligent use of talents bestowed, feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, welcoming the stranger, ministering to the ill and those in prison. Waiting and staying awake, therefore, is an active pursuit. Good evening.